Welcome to the Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery, where every death had a life and every life had a story. My name is Jenny Johnson.
Hello, and I'm Diane Hartshorn.
And welcome back to week two.
of your questions and our hopefully answers.
Yes. We realized when we recorded this the first time how long the episode became, and we decided we would split it into two episodes. So we're actually continuing the Q&A this week because we didn't want you to have to sit through a two-hour podcast. So thank you guys again for all the questions that you ask us on social media throughout the, again, these questions were based on a year's worth of social media posts that we put together. And then when Diane and I started kind of digging into some of the answers, that we ended up being a little long-winded sometimes.
But then it opened the door and ideas for other podcasts that we can work on this year for you all. And I hope it opens up other ideas like, hey, did you guys ever think of this? Because that's the ones we enjoy when people send us suggestions and we can go off on down rabbit holes.
I know. It's so much fun. So we're glad to have you back this week. We're going to jump right in and continue with last week's episode then.
Yeah. So this is an interesting one. Is it true that if someone is buried the opposite way of all the other graves, that means they committed suicide?
I don't think I've ever heard that one before.
No.
Usually, I was going to say, usually when I hear about suicides, especially before, you know, when it was considered a huge taboo and a huge sin, they weren't buried. They either weren't buried in the cemetery. They might be buried outside the cemetery, or they were buried in the quote unquote less desirable part of the cemetery. And they were usually unmarked in that case, kind of like a witch's grave or something else. I don't think I'd ever heard this. So I thought that was an interesting question.
So yeah, like when you mentioned outside of a cemetery, I think that would probably maybe pertain more to like the smaller church graveyards. Cause you know, technically a suicide is a sin depending on your, you know, religious belief, but
especially within the original like Catholic church. And
yes.
Stuff.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And I have never heard that because I know in our cemetery, and it goes back to the Christian thing, most people are buried east. Because, you know, supposedly, you know, to face the resurrection or the second coming. But so many people in our cemetery sometimes are buried what they call, I don't say backwards, but they're buried to face Pike's Peak. Because that is more important to them to be buried facing the mountain than the other. And also like the way our old cemetery, the older part, they would have pathways and walkways and all that through that. So sometimes and when they needed more land and those walkways were taken up and, you know, used for burial, some of these stones are like, aren't in nice, neat little rows.
Right.
So I think a lot of that is, and I don't think now that, anyway, long story short, or short story long, is I don't think that has anything to do with someone committing suicide.
I don't think so either. You know, with the rural cemetery movement, like you said, they were trying to make these garden settings. So stones were often placed in a way that would make it the most beautiful for somebody who's visiting the cemetery. So they may actually, and in some cases I've read, they will bury the bodies facing east, but the stones might be opposite, right? Like the opposite of, because it made more sense to the aesthetic view of the cemetery. You know, and like you said, the Christians believe that you're facing the second coming, facing Christ when he returns. There's also a pagan belief. If you go all the way back to the pagans, a lot of times they were buried to face the sunrise, because that was an important part of their belief system. And then if you go into Jewish tradition, a lot of times they're buried facing west, because they're wanting to face Israel, their homeland. So they will bury them facing west. And they also believe, and the Muslims also have a similar belief in west-facing positions, because then they're perpendicular to Mecca, which is their homeland. So again, it can be a religious thing, or a belief system. Sometimes it's the aesthetics of the graveyard. Sometimes it's just convenience. depending on how much land is available in the burial sites too. Or if you have cemeteries, I think this happens a lot, especially in like Europe, those old cemeteries that have been there forever. And they have so many bodies buried in them that at some point they just kind of end up being buried however they can fit them in. Because that's what happens. So as far as the suicide thing, like I said, I'd never heard that. So I thought that was an interesting question. But I think that that belief is maybe an old wives' tale.
I think so too.
So our next question was, how do you approach researching a subject? Thank you for those people who comment on how well researched our episodes are. It kind of depends. And for me, and I know you kind of do it a little differently, Diane, but for me, it depends on what the subject is. Mm-hmm. Depends on how I approach it. I mean, sometimes I will go to the library and try and find books or other resources through the library. That's harder than, or at least here, it's been harder when I do use the library. There's a lot of times they don't have, because I'm looking for something so specific, they don't have the books on what I want. So I end up buying a lot of my books because I'll have to find them, you know, through local resources. Of course, we use online sources. We look for the legitimate online resources. There's a lot of like museum websites, state databases, things like that, that we use. What's one of your favorite resources, Diane?
Definitely that, where you could get into, like, Colorado has a wonderful, the Colorado Historic Newspapers, where you can get on, and so many newspapers are digitized. So that's, you know, you're reading from primary sources. And I think it just depends, like Jenny said, like, and it's hard. I mean, Jenny does do most of, if not all, of the research, but she had me do one in regards to one of the cemeteries in Chicago, because like she said, you go down a rabbit hole. And when I started that one cemetery, I had to just find like four different topics and focus on those topics, because it was definitely one that you can go on and on. And usually what I'll do, I'll Google it. And of course, you know, Wikipedia comes up, and then I go down and I look at the resources that subject came up. And then I go to Ancestry, because more times than not, you might be able to find family resources. You wouldn't find anything else. And it's just, I mean, you know, we've had people come to us asking about things. And it seems like when we do a research and we're talking, especially when we have a guest, then that just opens up to so many other things. So it's just like, it's almost like you open up a can of worms and you just never know where it's going to take you. But we are very careful in when we find a fact, we try to see if it's repeated from other really legitimate resources, if this is true or not.
Right.
Because we did one where it was something about a witch and come to find out it was more,
it was the one in Plymouth where there was two graves we talked about where they had been rumored to be cursed by, you know, the witch. She never existed. She was a fictional story that had been written much, much later, but her story was repeated so often that even tour guides were repeating it. And the people were looking for her like house and her grave, and none of which existed because she never existed. So
I always like looking at the older newspaper articles and stuff, because once I guess a lie gets started, then if people don't go back far enough, then that lie is continued on, and then it becomes quote fact, which is, you know, folklore, but
and it changes
back. And it changes, so somebody else puts their own little spin on it, and then they're just perpetuating the lie. So I think it's, and I know Jenny does this, is go back to as much primary sources as you can.
I try really hard. And then, like you said, the other, and this can be really hard depending on the topic that we're researching, prioritizing what's important to talk about within that topic, because you can go down in so many rabbit holes, and it's super fascinating. But then I know when I'm putting it together for the episode specifically, I'm like, what what should our listeners hear? What makes the most sense sometimes from like a chronological standpoint of events happening? And sometimes you can find a lot of details and sometimes it's a struggle to find any details. So it is a method of prioritizing when you're going through and taking notes and reading and determining. And this is where, for me, my biggest struggle is not the research itself. I love doing the research. I could research all day long and be as happy as anything. It's sitting down and prioritizing what we're going to put in an episode and putting it together in the scripts that we use, because I tend to write scripts for us, because especially when we first started, we wanted to sound much more professional. We didn't want to be stumbling over our words so much. And even now we still do it. Even with a script, we will stumble, usually because we're reading the script weirdly. And then we look at that, or I will write something in the script really weird. And then I've done it so many times where I'm like, wait, what did I just say? And did that make sense? Did I write that? So that for me, it's the putting the scripts together every week. That's actually the trickiest part of doing all the research that we do, because that's where I have to really condense it down to make sense for what we're doing for an episode. There's a lot of note-taking, a lot of, I have a couple of notebooks now that are full of notes from all the note-taking, depending on the topic I'm researching, a lot of reading books, a lot of trying to find online sources. Ancestry.com is a favorite of mine, because you have birth and death certificates and census records and travel records. And, sometimes it dead ends and sometimes they're incorrect, but a lot of times it does help you to verify something that you may have read somewhere else or found somewhere else, and you can put the two and two together and you're like, oh yeah, this totally was a real person. And they lived from the state to the state and they, you know, they had this many children. We just actually, and this isn't even for the podcast, but, my mom was wanting to know. So her dad was, they had eight children in the family and they knew all the names of all the children, but they couldn't remember what order everybody was born in. And so I was able to actually go in and find a census record from 1950 that because I had to ask her, I'm like, do you know who the youngest one was, so that I would know whose name to make last. Sure was included last. And she had told me. And so I was able to find a census record from 1950 that were all eight of them were born by then. And we were able to then, because the ages were listed on the census record, we were able to put them in order from oldest to youngest. And it was interesting to me because I've seen different census records, depending on when they were taken, where they will list them that way, oldest to youngest. But this particular one listed all the boys and then all the girls. And so, and they were listed oldest to youngest, but it was all the boys, oldest to youngest, and then all the girls, oldest to youngest, even though they weren't born in that order. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen that. Usually it's they're by, you know, chronological age.
So. Right. So this one, I had to go back and look at the numbers. Or the ages to figure out the actual chronological, but we were able to find that information. She was thrilled. So it was like, and now you know who was born when. So we had figured that out. So that's kind of how we approach research. And then of course it depends again on the topic. Sometimes we will come across a topic because we read something, like we read a book or we read an article or whatever. And then from there we have to figure out what other resources and find those primary resources, like Diane said, which is not always easy. And there's been episodes we've scrapped because we couldn't find enough primary sources to make an episode happen.
And I think the other thing that we do is we step out of our current perceptions of things.
Yes.
And put ourselves in the place, try to put ourselves in the place of the person that we are just researching, because I think the biggest disservice we do to these people is to put today's perceptions and values and what we, you know, conceive as being the right thing on them, because it, you know, there's so much more that they had to live with. And yes, I'm sure they made choices that probably haunted them the rest of their lives, but it was that time and they did what they felt was the right thing. So we are very, I think we're empathetic, very empathetic to who we research, and we don't, we do not condemn, because I think we are I think Jenny and I, because we love history so much that we are very empathetic to the plights of, you know, a lot of the people that we do research and share their stories.
Right. And we may not always agree with their decisions or why they were doing certain things, but yes, we try and keep the context of the times in mind when we put their stories together, because yeah, you make decisions in your lifetime based on what's going on in your lifetime. And we all do. And sometimes it's a good thing and sometimes it's not such a good thing, but that's part of their story.
Exactly.
We got asked, what is the book that you talked about? And this is when we recorded with Salem, the podcast. Mm-hmm. I had to go back and look which episode that was when I found this question. Cause I was like, wait, what episode are we talking about? So what is the book that you talked about in the podcast about the poets who wrote death poems?
And that is The Graveyard School, an anthology. And actually, I got it myself and I haven't.
Did you get a copy?
Yeah, it's sitting on top of my shelf of books that I have. It's like, oh, I need to read that sometime because I think that is going to be a very cool book. So yeah, it's called The Graveyard School, an anthology. And I either got my copy on Amazon or Thrift Books.
Yeah, I got mine. Well, mine was definitely a thrifted book. I probably ordered it through a seller on Amazon, I think is where I got it. But it's definitely a used copy because I don't think it's actually currently in print. So if you find a copy, it's going to be a used copy. But it was, we had talked about in the episode, these poems that were written mainly in the 17 and early 1800s that all relay back to death in some way and to cemeteries and stuff, but they're very romantic poems in a lot of cases. And it was very popular, especially in the Victorian era, to read this type of poetry, to include it on headstones. You will find a lot of headstones that have verses on it from the Victorian era that are actually, that are actually from these poems. And so if you're interested, they're really good. I really like my copy of the book. We've used several of the poems from it or snippets of them in various episodes. So if you go back, you'll find this as a resource sometimes in some of our episodes, because it's just interesting poetry to read.
Because it's just neat to know where it came from. And who knows, we may do a podcast about the gentleman who wrote it down.
I'll let you take the next question.
Okay. So someone asked, and this is a hard one.
This was a really hard one.
Not that it's hard, but, again, prioritize. Can you recommend any good books about cemeteries? So if you're looking more for nonfiction, we recommend Stories in Stone, A Field Guide to Cemetery Symbolism and Iconography by Douglas Keister. Hope I said that right.
I think that's how you say it. That's how I say it.
And what's nice about that book, it's a narrow book. The one I have is a narrow book. And you
so can mine.
Throw it in your glove compartment and stuff. Because what was interesting, because when we were getting ready to do the wreath event, Tom and I went out and we were just walking. You were assigned certain blocks and we were, walking the blocks to place flags, and some that I knew because, I know the cemetery, they weren't marked as veterans, but I knew they were veterans. But there were several that we came across that I had never seen the symbology before. And one was like an eagle and had a circle around it. And I think it had the number 32 or something like that. So it looked more like a military Air Force symbol, if you didn't know better. And so I looked it up and it was actually a Masonic symbol.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Yeah.
And I was trying to think, 32nd. Yes. And so it was good to have a resource like that. Cause you could, assume one thing and find out it's totally not anything to do with what you think it is. So that's a good one. Where Are They Buried? How Did They Die? By Todd Benoit.
Okay. That one is really fun. That one goes into more details on more famous people and historical figures. I got it for Christmas, actually. I have not read it yet. But it was on my book wish list. And so it was gifted. My parents got it for me for Christmas. So I was all excited. So I'm looking forward to reading it. But yeah, if you're wanting to know more about a lot of famous people and where they're buried and how they died and other circumstances, it's a thick book. There's a lot in it. So
cool.
Yes.
Pioneer Cemetery Sculpture Gardens in the Old West. I believe I have this book myself, and it is a great, great book. She goes into a lot of detail, and I learned a lot. Yeah, that's a good book. And then
that was by Annette Stott.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
And she is actually local to Denver. She is a professor at the University of Denver, I believe. And she's also a member of the Association of Gravestone Studies. So I know she's written articles and stuff for them as well. But she's very knowledgeable.
We need to get her on the podcast.
I know.
And then 199 Cemeteries to See Before You Die by Lauren Rhodes.
Yes.
So if Jenny wants to take
that one and that book, if you haven't read, I know a lot of people have actually read this one because it's a more recent public. Some of these other ones are older publications that we mentioned, but 199 Cemeteries, it's a collection of worldwide cemeteries. So not just U.S. cemeteries, but cemeteries across the world. And it includes pictures and descriptions of the cemeteries and what makes them really special. So definitely check that one out because it's a favorite. Going into some fiction books, because I didn't know if this person, when this question was asked, if they meant just the nonfiction. So we decided to include fiction on our list too, because sometimes fiction is good too. My very, very favorite fiction book about cemeteries is The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman. I know a lot of people have read it. It's actually one of his young adult books, but the whole story takes place in a graveyard and involves the residents of the graveyard. And they're helping to raise a young boy who ends a young living boy who ends up there. And it's a fascinating story. And there's a lot of twists and turns to it. And it's definitely, you know, Neil Gaiman's style of storytelling. But I love The Graveyard Book. It is definitely one of my favorites. Also, I added to the list, although I've personally never read it. I don't know if you've read it. Pet Nope. Cemetery by Stephen King. I know it's about a cemetery. I've seen clips of the movie. I've never actually read it. I don't think I've ever read a Stephen King novel.
No, I think I when I was in college, I quickly browsed Christine, and that was enough for me.
Yeah, I've read some of his short stories, but I've never actually read any of his novels. But I know I have so many friends who are huge Stephen King fans, and so I did add that to the list. If you're looking for a fiction book about a cemetery.
So Stephen, if you're listening, please don't take that personally.
Yeah, please don't. It's not, I actually do want to read The Shining, you know, since it is based out of the Stanley Hotel, and I have been to the Stanley and I have toured the Stanley. And for that reason alone, I want to read The Shining. I know he's got a power of telling stories that's really scary. And I don't know if I want to go down, although I've read V.C. Andrews and other authors that are just as macabre, but I just haven't been able to bring myself to read any of his books. The next book on the list is one that I learned about through you, Diane.
The Spoon River Anthology by Edgar Lee Masters. It's an older book. It's a small book, but it's written differently in that, like, each page is someone talking, and it's way he wrote it is almost in dialogue. So for me, I had to read several pages at a time to get in the idea. It's a dialogue. And I think if I remember right, it's been so long since I've read it. It's like a running dialogue.
Yes.
Through the book.
So and it's like, the dialogue of the people buried in the cemetery.
Yeah. Right? The dialogue of the people buried in the cemetery. So it's a running dialogue with them. And, you know, you read one and it sort of connects back to another one. And it's, I need to pull it out and read it again because it was a cool book. I like how it's written.
Was it last year or the year before that we did it for our New Year's episode? I think parts of it. Like, we didn't do the whole book, obviously, but we picked some of the dialogues. I don't remember what year it was. I think it was that first year. I'll see if I can figure out which episode it was, and I'll try and link it in the show notes in case anybody's interested. The next one is The Whole Town's Talking by Fannie Flagg. So if you know, Fannie Flagg wrote, probably her most well-known book is Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe, which, you know, was made into a very popular movie. But The Whole Town's Talking mostly takes place from the cemetery in the town. It starts with the history of the town and how it was founded back in the 1800s. But then, of course, as the folks die, they get buried on this cemetery on the hill. And then a lot of the story is told from the perspective of what's happening as the decades progress. And the dead are watching their descendants and things like that. And it's Fanny Flagg is one of my most favorite storytellers. She just has a way of writing that's easy to read. It's fun. And you feel like the way she describes the people and the places and the things that are going on, you feel like you're right there with her or with the characters. Fun. So that's a definite fun read from a cemetery. That's fiction. Yeah. And then the last ones, I just have books in general by Simone St. James. She's another one of my favorite authors. I've read every single one of her books. They don't necessarily specifically all take place in cemeteries, but the dead are often involved in her books, in her stories. And there's a lot of murder mysteries and things like that. And there, she, again, if you like sort of a thriller standpoint of a story, she's a great author to read. And most of her stories, the dead are somehow involved in the telling of her stories. And so they're also all really good. And then...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, these are, I don't know if you have some, but on my to be read list, these are both fiction. Falling Angels by Tracy Chevalier. I guess this is sort of a follow-up to, oh goodness, I can't think of what the book is, but the idea of the story is there's two girls that are very fascinated by a particular cemetery and it leads them down rabbit holes and I think causes some trouble. So that one sounded interesting. And then Cemetery Girl by David Bell, which I think is sort of a murder mystery. I know the basic premise is that a little girl goes missing for several years, but is found alive and has something to do with that time that she was missing. I think she spent in a cemetery. So
cool. Yeah,
those are both on my to be read when I have time to read.
Yeah, when you have time to sit.
It's like, well, and right now I'm currently listening to it. So I consider reading. I know some readers don't. I consider listening to an audiobook the same as reading a book. And I do listen to a lot of audiobooks because of my day job. I'm in the car a lot, so I can listen to them. But I am currently listening to the Wizard of Oz series of books, all of them.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, because we are doing a production this spring for the Douglas County Public Schools that will be involved in the Wizard of Oz. And I will be putting a script together based on the story. And I decided I was going to listen to all of them and try and base the whole thing off of maybe once some of the stories we're not as familiar with in the series. And I've never actually read them all, so.
I've read one, the first one or whatever. And it's so different than the movie. It's so, so different.
Right. Silver Shoes instead of Ruby Slippers and Glinda, who's not even actually named Glinda, I don't think, in the book. But she's a little old lady and she's wearing white instead of pink. You know, so many differences, but it's great.
So the next question is, and you're probably going to have to answer this, are you guys on other streaming platforms or only your own website? So we are on all the podcasts, pretty much all the podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple Podcast,
Google Podcasts, Stitcher.
Yeah, anything you go into that you listen to podcast on, you will be able to find us.
Yes. And I think this question just came up because when I post our weekly episodes to our social media accounts, the link I always post with them is the link to our actual website. And that's because to me personally, when I put the podcast episodes out, there's always a description and stuff included, but it's just, to me, easier to read through our website. And it's easier to find our show notes if you're looking for the resources and things. So that's why I always link the website on the social medias. But yes, if you listen on any other platform that does podcast, you will find us. We're on all of them.
Because I don't listen to podcasts a lot, but I have a whole list that I want to listen to. And so I just go to the websites because it's easier for me to find the specific episode than trying to remember what it was called and da 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 da.
Right. Yeah. And certain platforms, they only allow us to, they will only show like so many episodes at a time in their databases because, you know, they've got so many. Where again, if you want to find like one of our very first episodes, you'll find it more easily on our website than you might find it on some of the other platforms. And then our last question, we're getting to the end. This pertains to the Granary Burying Ground, which is in Boston, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked, does anyone know if the Granary ever had a list of those buried in the cemetery? It's a complicated answer. It's really no. Ultimately. So the cemetery was founded in 1660. So it's one of the country's oldest cemeteries. There are 2,345 gravestones and tombs that are marked, but there's an estimated 5,000 people buried in that cemetery, which if you've never been there, I've been to it a couple times now. It's not a very big cemetery and it's surrounded by buildings on three sides and then a street on the one side. So to think of the fact that there's 5,000 bodies buried in this little space is kind of overwhelming almost.
Is it a graveyard? Was it next to a church at one time?
It was just a burial ground. Yeah. Okay. It was technically named, I think, before they started calling it the Granary Burying Ground, I think it was the King's Church Burying Ground, but there's no church there. The reason it became the Granary is because they had a grain mill built right there. And so it was next to the grain mill, which made sense in people's mind. We'll call it the Granary because it's next door to the grain mill.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And it contains the monuments, just in case people are wondering, most of them are slate in that particular cemetery, but there are some that are also greenstone and marble. And then if you want to read that little bit about
sure.
who is there that we know, go for it.
Okay, so there's what is called the Infant's Tomb, where hundreds of children have been interred. Is located near the central obelisk that marks the grave of Benjamin Franklin's parents. Alongside the far wall and the elaborately embellished obelisk marks John Hancock's tomb. Paul Revere is buried near the back of the granary. A large marker placed in the 19th century stands by a smaller, older slate marker. Matching stones in the two front corners of the burial ground commemorate James Otis and Samuel Adams. That's incredible to even think.
Right.
Next to the stone for Adams is the grave markers for the victims of the Boston Massacre. And on the right-hand wall is a plaque marking the tomb of Robert Treat Paine, the third signer of the Declaration of Independence, buried in the granary, the others being, of course, John Hancock and Samuel Adams.
So yeah, several founding fathers buried there or their family members, or at least buried there.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot of history in that. But as far as like a complete list, I don't think that exists. Again, with 2,300 marked stones, and some of those stones are unreadable now. If you go, they're covered in moss. The inscriptions have just worn off over almost 400 years. So, you know, there we may not know, unless there's records somewhere, we may not know who all of those belong to.
So in your research, from what you could find, of course, you know, there's not a lot written back from the 1600s. Since it wasn't attached to the church, so there would be no church records. Would people just come and then bury their loved ones on their own?
So when it was founded, it was primarily a Puritan cemetery. So we'd go back okay. to, so they would have done their Puritan ceremony of, you know, the quiet burial. Whatever the members of the community probably were there, but yeah, if there are written records for some of those burials, they may not exist anymore.
Okay.
So to have that complete written list, it would be awesome if there was something out there. And I'm sure there's people researching it all the time. It is, the granary is part of the Freedom Trail, which is a trail that you can mm-hmm. follow when you're in Boston that hits a lot of the historical sites pertaining to the Revolutionary War and the founding of America as a country. And so it's one of the stops along the Freedom Trail. And so I know they're constantly researching like all of those locations.
Yeah. And the Freedom Trail is also attached to the Underground Railroad as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's we've done it the first time I've visited, and I've done it a couple of times, and I've done pretty much the whole thing where we've gone to all the locations, but then I've also gone back and only gone to certain locations that we wanted to explore further. But, you know, there's other, along with the granary, you're going to find like Paul Revere's house is on the Freedom Trail. So you can stop and visit his house. It's a hill. I can't think of it. Bunker Hill is on the Freedom Trail. So there's a lot of places that have where the Boston Massacre occurred is right there on the Freedom Trail. It's kind of in the middle of the street. There's a little star that marks the spot where the first person died. All of that is along the Freedom Trail. So if you're ever touring Boston and you don't know what to tour, but you're into history and American history and stuff, that's a really good place to start. There are tour guides that you can do it. We haven't never done it with a tour guide. We've always just done it on our own, but there's a lot of guidebooks out there that you can take with you. And that includes stops. Oh yeah. The Old North Church is part of that too. You know, where Paul Revere hung the lanterns. So there's a lot on that Freedom Trail. If you're ever in Boston and don't know where to start, it's a good starting point.
Everything's so condensed there. Back there and so tight. Here you got to drive sometimes right. Miles in between things. Yeah. So that's really cool.
It's very like you can walk a good chunk of that in one day and see a lot of those sites in one day. Now, if you want to explore those sites more, like I said, you can tour Paul Revere's house. That takes a little bit of time. You can tour the Old North Church, which there's it doesn't cost anything to go into the church and see the church itself. They mm-hmm. do offer, or at least they were offering, I'm assuming they're still offering an additional tour that you do pay for that takes you in to the vaults that are the burial vaults beneath the church.
Oh, wow.
And when we took that, so we went into the vaults beneath the church and found out who's buried down there. And again, some founding fathers and things are down there. But that tour also included going up into the bell tower. So, that was one of our favorite tours that we did in Boston, partially because it was not very expensive, which was great. But also at that particular day, it ended up just being the three of us that were together. So it was like a private tour. And so our tour guide could totally devote her time to answering our questions, explaining things, telling us more stories than maybe she would have if we'd been a bigger group. Mm-hmm. And then being in those tight spaces under the church and above the church like that, only having the three of us made it very easy to go in and see it, take pictures, and really enjoy that tour. So I highly recommend that if you're going to Boston.
Well, and a lot of times people don't want to pay for things. They just want to do the free stuff, which, you know, that's fine. But it's also, you know, that money is going back to the preservation and the upkeep of the site. And that's, you know, it's not like, you know, we have to invest in our history. So that's a good way to do it.
So that is a tour I highly recommend. We loved doing it, but I do know if you're there, there are tours where you can get a guide, especially for the granary, that can tell you more stories about the granary and some of those folks buried there. But I cannot find a dedicated list. Like I said, it may exist. I just don't have access to it. That tells you all 2,523 marked graves, let alone the 5,000 that are buried there. So
there was no record keeping, and chances are, it sounds like there may not have been or wasn't consistent, which makes sense for
us. Well, and you have to think over the course of Boston's history, there were epidemics and things like that happening. So sometimes the bodies were buried quickly just to get them out of the way because they had to. So they may not always be recorded.
So we are so happy. This was a long one. To begin another year of learning all about cemeteries. And it's obvious Jenny and I are very, very passionate about this and sharing these stories with you. And of course, the stories buried within. And we are so grateful to have you, our listeners, along for the journey. To learn more about us or to find resources we've used on past episodes, please be sure to visit our website, theordinaryextraordinarycemetery.com.
And keep those questions, comments, and episode suggestions, because we always like those too, on social media coming. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery and on Twitter at Ord Extra Sim.
Until we meet again.